WUGA's Artist in Residence this month is painter and photographer Judith McWillie, whose paintings are in the collections of both the Morris Museum in Augusta and the Georgia Museum of Art. She's here in the studio today to talk about the event. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks so much for coming. Can I ask you to start out by just giving us a little, can you tell us a little bit about your background, please?
All right, thank you. Well, I'm a native of Memphis, Tennessee. I was born in 1946, grew up there, and went to graduate school at Ohio State. That was in the early 1970s. Went back to teach in my undergrad alma mater, Memphis State, for 3 years, and then got the phone call from UGA. And I've been here since 1974.
You grew up in Memphis, and you were drawn to art at an early age. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what drew you in?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting about the city in the 50s, because there was really only one art museum, almost no galleries. There was an art school.
Mm-hmm.
And how I got involved with art, it escapes me until I try to dig back and realize that everywhere you looked, there were amazing people who made things. Some were just street performers. There were other people who'd built sculpture in their yard. And I came in contact with what is now called, you know, so-called folk art. I don't call it that, or outsider art, before I ever went to school to learn about modernism and historical art movements. So I really honestly think that's what did it. And I started photographing some of these Memphis spaces in 1969 when Bill Christenberry was one of my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky to have him as a teacher because he emphasized culture being really important in addition to making.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was really nothing going on in the South that anyone knew about at the time. I mean, there certainly was a great literary tradition and the blues tradition, but it was clear to anybody visually oriented that there was also a visual tradition, but it had never been explored.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Christenberry was in the process of transitioning out of Memphis State to the Corcoran in D.C. He was my teacher his first 2 years out of school, and there was always something exciting happening, including him and his friend William Eggleston staging happenings. We would come to the class for drawing, and instead we'd see a living room painted, everything painted white, and these two mad men would jump in with axes and, you know, crack it all up and then leave. And then we'd read about the happenings in New York with Robert Rauschenberg, another Southerner, you know. And so it was more like just people getting together and being creative. There wasn't even a fixed curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I have been so lucky to have had that experience, because I still find the reach of that influence to be enriching and beautiful.
Now, you've referenced a number of art media in this discussion so far, but I've heard that you said that your first love is painting. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, painting is like deep meditation. It is an in-depth process. The way I approach it, I don't even know what the painting I'm making is about until I'm almost three quarters of the way through the painting.
Really?
So it's a form of, if you want to say this, divination in a way.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is on a lot of things, not necessarily art historical. And I do believe in expertise. I think that every painter should have a certain degree of expertise. And I began to be fascinated with color and abstraction really early.
Mm-hmm.
And so all I can, to put it simply, what I can tell you is that you know you're on the right track if when you leave the studio, even if you've been there 6 hours, if you have more energy than you had when you walked in there, then you're onto something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you come back and back and back, and then it finally reveals itself to you what the painting is about. And this is a little bit different than, you know, a formal kind of approach. And there's tremendous knowledge to be had on that level.
How do you know when the work is done?
Well, I have to quote another artist, one of my favorites, Via Selmans, who once said about her drawings, "I know it's done when it's packed with attention."
Mm-hmm.
It's a mysterious thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my paintings, some of them are one single color.
Yeah.
they would call them minimalist. I would not call them minimalist.
Mm-hmm.
There might be 30 layers underneath the color.
Yeah.
And I think it makes a big difference. If I just came in and painted the canvas cobalt blue and hung it up, I don't think it would have the same transmittive power as mm-hmm. something that where there's a lot of attention packed in there.
Yeah.
You know.
You referenced your days growing up in Memphis and the influence that the Memphis community had on you, sort of ushering you into the art world.
Mm-hmm.
Can we see that influence in your paintings today?
Okay. It's interesting, but I don't know that that influence is there aesthetically. In mm-hmm. fact, one of the things that was very different about my undergraduate schooling and my graduate school was as we were in the South without a real established art scene, or you know, it was very raw then.
Mm-hmm.
You were supposed to find your own aesthetic and your own image and not copy anybody else.
Yeah.
You loved art history. You understood what constituted a master. You know, you could go to the museum and marvel, but you had to find your own path, your own aesthetic. And so I consciously didn't want to be influenced aesthetically by the art that I saw.
Mm-hmm.
But 30 years later, particularly in one instance, I'm willing to say there might have been a subconscious influence, but there was an enormous influence in another sense. One of the people that I knew about before I even attended art school was an African Native American healer who had a practice on the edge of town, south of town.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his family created these monumental works, and they were abstract. They looked almost like, a sculpture that you would see in Art Forum, and yet they were here on the Mississippi-Tennessee line, you know, in a swamp in Memphis. Well, he was a root doctor, a traditional healer, and the real thing. And I went to see him.
Mm-hmm.
And would, you know, get out there as much as I could and get a glimpse of these images. Well, it took almost 20 years before he would talk to me. But when we finally got together in the early 80s, I learned more from him about art. He would not call what he did art, but it was, quote, it was sacred medicine.
Hmm.
And because he was a healer, there were a lot of people that came in out of there every day. I would sit sometimes for hours and, you know, wait until he was done. So I think my early exposure to those kinds of people has influenced everything I've done since then. And the reason is it's like they go back to the core of what gave art its authority in the world initially.
Mm-hmm.
How lucky could you be, you know, than to have access to people like that?
Right.
But I had the credentials, and I had the institutional backing because I had a degree. I'm a credentialed artist. No one knew about these people.
Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, a lot of artists all over the South began to document and try to promote these people and let the world know that these things were here. And the beautiful thing is 30 years later now, it's very established. I call it Black Atlantic art or African Atlantic art. It's in museums all over the world now, some of these artists. So I was only one of many people who wanted to show the world what was happening.
Now, how does that tie in to what you have referenced previously as vernacular art, African American vernacular art? Art.
That's another. That's the term that's just used today most commonly. African Atlantic art. I get that from Robert Ferris Thompson,
mm-hmm.
and it connotes the traditions involved. And this is the other thing: vernacular art has tradition too, but it has a different frame of reference mm-hmm. than I have. I'm grateful for my art education and that I have a BFA and an MFA because it taught me a common language that I can share with people in the art world all over the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Very necessary, and it gave me access, all right? But the quality of the work produced by some of these artists, like Washington Harris, mm-hmm. the traditional healer, is on par with contemporary sculpture. And therefore, there wasn't any quality difference. There were great vernacular artists and some that were not so great,
you know,
just as there are anywhere. But it's a different frame of reference.
Mm-hmm.
And not having grown up with art, you know, as a constant, and no museums to see contemporary art, really, except once or twice a year, that became far more important than it might have been
mm-hmm.
if I had grown up in a city, art city, you know, like New
right.
York or L.A. or
How
Houston.
Does, or maybe I should ask, does their work influence yours?
It influences it philosophically. I try to stay away from it aesthetically mm-hmm. because I still have that kind of thing, that southern thing, that whatever, that that I should build my aesthetic mm-hmm. out of whatever I have taken to heart.
Mm-hmm.
And with an ear towards, yes, art history and contemporary art criticism, which I'm a big fan of and mm-hmm. I love it. But I have to work out of my own experience.
Right.
The other point about that is that when I left the South to go to grad school, I found that quite the contrary, that people did want you to make paintings that referenced Matisse or Gorky and all. And that was so strange to me because it was such a no-no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a teacher would come in undergraduate and he'd go, oh, I see you've been looking at de Kooning. You know, like, don't copy anybody.
Mm.
Find it here.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that that was odd until I left. Went to the Midwest.
Having had the experience learning under teachers with different perspectives like that,
mm-hmm.
how did you reconcile that and guide your students in the years that followed?
Well, again, most institutions are set up, you know, with very specific tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And so my student, the way the art school was structured at the time, we had drawing and painting, and I taught mm-hmm. in that area. And I taught color, and I taught drawing sometimes, and I taught various painting courses at different levels, graduate and art. And then there were the lecture courses. And if a studio person wanted to teach a seminar or a lecture course, you could.
Mm-hmm.
And so I taught a couple of seminars over the time I was there. One was called, I actually titled it Black Folk Art because that's what the public called this work. And then the whole course was about how it wasn't folk art. it was even more. and then I taught later almost... right before I retired, I taught a seminar called Thinkenstein,
mm-hmm.
which was about contemporary culture. There would be some discussion, some, you know, carryover.
Right.
And I would talk about the artists that I knew and sometimes show my tapes to my studio students,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Did you, sort of hitting on that point again where you your first exposure was from a perspective that you don't borrow these influences, and then later
mm-hmm.
they wanted you to borrow these influences. What was your take on that?
Well, the important thing is to know that it's regional, and I mm-hmm. think it's significant that in the South, where there was not a real developed art collecting
mm-hmm.
of contemporary art, that... first of all, how did we wind up together anyway as artists, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because there was something about us, God knows what, but I know I never looked back. I knew I wanted to be an artist in the fifth grade, and I just considered it be a burden off of my shoulders that I already knew what I was going to be, and I just didn't think about it again and did it.
One less thing to worry about.
One less thing to worry. Oh, okay, that's good. But in the Midwest, where there's a very developed dealer, collector tradition, it's 6 hours. We were 6 or 7 hours from New York
mm-hmm.
all the time. There's that whole idea of a succession, like a dynasty, like, oh, you're coming from abstract expressionism, or you're coming. And that way, if you allowed influences and even imitated other artists in the course of learning about art, that was not only okay, it was desirable.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, well, then my man is Marcel Duchamp, the guy that put the bicycle wheel on the stool and exhibited it in a museum. He's my guy.
Mm-hmm.
My guy is Kazimir Malevich, the guy that painted and painted and then finally ended up just putting a black square over the top of it. That's my guy. And these were the two sort of fountains, you know, the headwaters of
yeah.
Of early modernism, these two.
Mm-hmm.
And then love filmmaking. At the time, I was more influenced by filmmaking even than by visual art.
Can you talk a little bit about your filmmaking?
Well, it started off as documentation. Again, no one knew about these artists. And there were other people across the South making, you know, films, fielded. It was mostly anthropologists, but there was a little group of artists that liked to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't afford to go into any kind of editing that was available to me at the time. So I just cut these films in my attic. And they accompanied lectures that I was giving. I lectured a lot in those years. And initially they were made to show in the lectures. But there was one artist that I was particularly obsessed with, really, in the same sense that Washington Harris, you know, was somebody special. I'm doing a book on him now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was J.B. Murray, who lived in Central Georgia. And I said, this one is going to be the one that I want to make it into a film. And it's accessible on YouTube, and it's called J.B. Murray, M-U-R-R-A-Y. Writing in the spirit, reading through the water, and it's about 20 minutes long. And you have to be pretty agile too when you're out here. So
yeah.
I was painting and doing articles, you know, on these artists for arts journals,
mm-hmm.
and also teaching, and always viewed this as one thing, one vision. But as I said, you know, the bureaucracies divide all these things up, and so now that I'm retired, I've had the freedom to pull everything together.
Yeah. Last year, your paintings were part of a special event at the Smithsonia Plantation out in Oglethorpe County. Can you talk a little bit about the venue and what it meant to have your work displayed there?
Well, I believe that was the first time where everything came together. First of all, it was a collaboration between James DeMolino, who was the owner, the new owner of, mm-hmm. of the land and the plantation house, and he had just finished a three-year renovation of the plantation, restoration.
Mm-hmm.
And one afternoon in the Grit restaurant, I was talking with two of the people I ended up collaborating with, and the first news of the Baldwin burials came out.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a little conversation, and somehow in that conversation said, let's collaborate on an event. It was a collaboration between Peter Sloan, a composer, Steve Scurry, a poet who lives here.
Mm-hmm.
Peter lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico now. Mocha and Noah Johnson, who I knew through the Hip Hop Awards,
mm-hmm.
who have become activists and producers, and Purvis Young, who was deceased, but his paintings were shown because James has a large collection.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was the producer slash director. There were a lot of performers. I wish I could name everybody. I wish
yeah.
we had time. And many, many moving parts. But essentially, we decided that as the physical space had been restored, we wanted a spiritual restoration. And we knew about the native people who were buried there and, of course, the history of convict leasing.
Well, let's stop
yeah.
right there. For
okay.
listeners who don't know about the mm-hmm. history of the Smithsonia Plantation, can you give us a little background on that?
It was built just after the Civil War by James Monroe Smith. He built essentially an agricultural empire out there, which a lot of people already know about.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also a scene of great violence. And I'm fifth generation Southern. I certainly had slave owners in my ancestors. And I've always believed that that there would be a way to create some kind of restoration of moral integrity, not by denying, but by claiming and owning up. And luckily, James DeMolino had that same attitude. And this was a ceremony, even more than a performance,
mm-hmm.
in which we adopted the ancestors, the people who were buried there,
mm-hmm.
Both the convicts as well as the native people. We asked them if we could be their ancestors, if they could be our common ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had members of the hip-hop community, Life the Griot, Elite Ellison, African Soul, Drina Williams, and mm-hmm. Celeste Negev, come in, and they essentially did spoken word and improv, and some mid-century jazz musicians from Atlanta. I say mid-century, they liked mid-century experimental music.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all done improvisationally. We didn't even have a rehearsal. So it was, you know, do or die.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't talk about it or publicize it much because I felt that if it didn't work, that it would be the worst case of artist hubris anyone could ever, you know, have ever committed.
But
about 150 people came and
did it work?
It did. And it was more than any of us, even bargained for or could have imagined. And people have asked about, you know, performing it again, but it could not be performed again. But
right.
I do have videotape, mm-hmm. which I'll have a little tape available on Saturday, where you'll see one performance from it and some other quick excerpts of this temple I mentioned, A Drive By, and also the Murray film.
Could you please talk about your ideas about the role of artists in society? How do you see your job as an artist?
Great question. I see myself as a culture worker. Now, I'm also a maker, and indebted to that, I probably would not have made it. I probably wouldn't be alive now if I couldn't make art. But because that was never drummed out of me early, because I had a teacher like Christenberry who was all about, in his case, Southern culture, I paid attention and relished paying attention to the world around me and the culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so the role of the artist, I believe, and have felt this way my whole life, is the artist comes in, looks at the world, sees it differently than maybe you did before, or maybe than a lot of people. But the artist, the impulse is, what is needed here? What is needed here? And that is why Washington Harris' philosophy of art as sacred medicine touched such a chord.
Mm-hmm.
What is needed here? So I'm a culture worker. If you want to call me that, rather than argue with anybody, you know, in the past, people, are you an anthropologist or an artist? I'm certainly not. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't have a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to call me a culture worker, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only because of art that I could do anything else. If I was not thinking and doing and being reinforced by other artists about, you know, the way you approach these things,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have accomplished very much. So I'm not asking everybody to be that. Luckily, art is a very rich field with mm-hmm. many layers. But I think addressing culture, and, you know, that's what's kept me going.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis of the things I've written.
Okay. And we've got this event coming up that you were so kind to agree to host. What are we going to see?
Oh, well, you're going to see works from the past 6 years or so. I've never really given the body of work a name, not yet. I just have always said, those black paintings. They're very nighttime. I spend a lot of time working at night because it's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to show several paintings that were in the Beloved Land event in the rooms in the plantation, with interacting with the ceremonial parts. And you'll see some of that on a tape. The paintings will be there, but also some very large format photographs of the night sky that are basically coming out of a preoccupation with coincidence and synchronicity.
Mm-hmm.
That I've been involved with for about, 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so each of these images is a coincidence that occurred in the sky. And there are a lot of them if you go out at night and watch. And I thought the camera was a perfect vehicle for these, because it's about light and time, and that's what the sky is about. That's what you see. So you'll see large format photographs and paintings. There'll be some of these films, a short little thing on a screen somewhere in another room if anybody wants to see. And then a stack I've been making in the last year or two sort of these books based on social media. I view them as artist books, and there'll be a stack of those. So it'll be wild, and there'll be something in every room of the house to experience.
Terrific. Judith McWillie, WUGA's featured artist in residence this month, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you for hosting the event as well.
Well, and thanks to Pat Priest and everyone else who does the artist in residence. It's very so important for us to be able to have conversations like this one. Thank you.
The event at her home is from 3 to 5 p.m. on Saturday, June 24th. Art professor Janice Simon, who has won numerous awards for her teaching, will also provide insights into Judith's work. at the event. For more information or to RSVP, you can reach Abby Thaxton at thaxtona@uga.edu or 706-542-9842. Remember that space is limited. For WUGA, I'm Michael Carton.